Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Human activities are altering rivers and ocean ecosystems in dramatic ways. Science is one way of knowing this and of communicating it, but it's not always the most effective way. Robert F. Perkins is a multimedia artist who has been solo canoeing in the Arctic and elsewhere for close to 30 years. He's canoed the Limpopo River in Africa and also the Connecticut River right here in our own backyard. He's written books and produced films about his experiences, and now some of his paintings are part of an exhibit at the Sargent Gallery in Aquinnah called Risk and the Marine Environment. He joins me now via Skype from his home near Zion National Park. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Heather. Pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with the title of this new exhibit, Risk and the Marine Environment. There are a fair number of different ways that you could parse that out. What's your interpretation of that and what it means for the artwork that's in this exhibit?
I think that risk is a word that raises concerns about what we're thinking of. And we're mainly in the exhibit thinking of the oceans, but the rivers feed the oceans. And the risk is that both the rivers and the oceans are becoming contaminated and are threatened with more contamination. And the hope is to bring consciousness to this state of affairs.
When you say contamination, what kinds of things are you talking about?
Well, I think that there's a lot of chemical that goes in it. There's a lot of plastic in the ocean now. There's huge amounts of overfishing. Any number of things that I think most people would be aware of. And I guess that my part in the exhibition is to bring a slightly different slant, which is to say that I believe science is fabulous in its accuracy and capacity to prove things. But I think it's the human heart that actually makes people change their attitudes. And that's the expectation and hope of the exhibition, that people that see it would have a moment to reflect not only on the science side of our oceans and rivers, but on the heartfelt experience.
The Arctic is a part of the world that most people don't get to experience firsthand. You're in the minority there, and you have spent a fair bit of time fairly intimately exploring the Arctic by solo canoeing. What kinds of changes have you noticed as you have visited the Arctic over the years?
One of the things that distinguishes my work is that I chose to stay on one watershed. That's the watershed surrounding the Great Fish River, or the Back River, as it's known in northern Canada. It spans the Northwest Territory and Nunavut and flows freely for 650 miles. Over the 16 different summers I've spent there solo canoeing, and also the research that I've done, has indicated that it is relatively untouched by the contaminations that its southern cousin rivers have been exposed to by overpopulation or more population. In the current decade, there have been diamond mines that have been discovered in that part of the world, and that's bringing in a huge, larger number of people.
You've visited isolated Native communities in the Arctic. Are there also, in addition to some of the ecological changes that are happening, are there cultural changes taking place?
Well, they're both happening. And I'm thinking of a friend of mine in Baker Lake who had really never seen the size of a dragonfly that appeared one summer. And they thought it was just a bigger mosquito. They were terrified by it. And it came that far north because of the warming climate.
When you think about
I was wondering what the second half of your question was.
Well, just what kinds of cultural changes? How are people in the Arctic responding to the changing environment?
Yeah, they're coping as best they can. They're doing very well. The Inuit have organized themselves, and the Canadian government has created a territory called Nunavut, which is the first time a native population has control over a territory that they lived in for thousands of years. That's a big step.
When you think about all the different rivers that you've canoed on, from the Arctic all the way down to southern Africa and in between, are there parallels that you see from your experiences there?
Yes, again, it's a pretty simple formula. The more people are around the river, the more potential there is for its being contaminated. On the Connecticut River, when I canoed it some years back, it were the cows, the farmers who still had the cows waiting in the river. There was no pretense of trying to keep them out. And that's true in Africa on the Limpopo River. And it was true in Siberia when I traveled down the Kamchatka River on that peninsula as the first American to be invited to travel in that very closed and secretive part of Russia.
Not all of your canoeing journeys have been solo journeys, but you have done many solos. What is so compelling? What is so powerful about that solo experience?
If you go by yourself, you actually develop a relationship with the nature around you to a degree you wouldn't when you're with someone else. You'd always want to be caring for a group or another person and always looking in their eyes. When you travel alone in the Arctic, which is totally an environment that remains the same after 5,000, 6,000 years, the eyes watching you are the animals and the creatures, and the silence and solitude that you live in during that period of time not only brings you more familiar to yourself, but brings you into connection and contact with things you would totally miss if you were in a group, primarily because in a group you make noise.
Obviously, you've had film crews along for a handful of your canoe voyages to then subsequently make films from, but when you are solo, how do you document or record those journeys for yourself?
Oh, it wasn't planned at all. My career in documentary making came out of a desire to show people at home that there was actually something of interest in the Arctic instead of the old slideshow. But you can mount a camera in the front of the canoe and be sitting in the stern and you're paddling. It makes a great platform for a camera. And then you can take those small cameras out and around. I used a 150, and that was the biggest camera I had. And it allows you to have the intimacy of what we're very familiar with today, of the confessional and reality TV shows. But at my time, it was some of the first footage where you could be actually seeing something in nature unfold as you watched.
I'm particularly curious about how you translate your solo canoeing experiences into paintings. Are you working from video, working from memory, painting as you go? What's the process for you?
I am working as I go very much. I always bring a large box of pastels, and the bottom of my canoe is black, so I often use it as a canvas to do a pastel on in the evening to pass the time. But I do many watercolors and while I'm on the trip, and then when I'm back home, it is the imagination that comes into play when I want to convey something of a bird or a landscape or water. I'm really not interested in the anatomical detail of a bird or a fish. I'm interested in their spirit and capturing something like that. And the painters I turn to would be the early Marsden Hartley, the early American painters Dove, the Western painter Morris Graves is a hero of mine.
You've worked with poets before, collaborating to create paired poems and paintings. Have you ever done anything similar or thought of doing something similar with scientists who are studying the rivers that you have canoed and explored?
Well, Heather, I love that idea. That's the first time I would have ever even considered it. And it's a lovely idea because it would bring the science into a more humanistic environment. I'd love to do it. If there were a scientist out there that would like to participate with me, let me know.
Well, we have scientists right here in Woods Hole who study some of the Arctic and Siberian rivers, so we'll have to connect you.
That would be a pleasure.
You have taken the solo experience back home with you now. You live off the grid near Zion National Park. Can you describe your home and the inspiration for the way that you live right now?
Well, when I came here 18 years ago, it felt to me that I had this 140,000 acres of wilderness, which is Zion National Park, out my back door. And that here I was on another canoeing expedition but with a fixed roof. And when the winter rye, which is now turned to yellow, has wind blow through it, it looks very much like water. It mimics it.
That sounds beautiful. Can you describe some of the work that you have in this exhibit that's opening at the Sargent Gallery? Is there a message that you're trying to get across to viewers?
Mm-hmm. I am trying to reach a viewer. I'm trying to show them that beyond the surface there lies a spirit inside animals and fish and landscape, something that we don't often acknowledge because in science we are often calling things an it and objectifying them. So I like to think that the work I do and the other artists in the exhibition are showing people something of the inner nature of what they are going to see in the birds, the fish, the oceanscapes.
Robert Perkins is one of three artists whose work makes up the exhibit Risk and the Marine Environment, currently open at the Sargent Gallery in Aquinnah. He joined us via Skype from his home near Zion National Park. Rob, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Heather.
If Robert Perkins has you contemplating your connection to the marine environment, we'd love it if you'd share some of those thoughts with us. Living Lab Radio is partnering with a visiting researcher in Woods Hole this summer on a survey of attitudes toward the ocean. The poll is targeted toward residents of Falmouth, and you can find a link on our website, capeandislands.org. But regardless of where you live, we want to hear your stories about your relationship with the ocean, whether it's a relaxing day at the beach, commercial or recreational fishing, or going to sea for research or fun. You can leave us a voicemail at 508-289-1285, and we may use your story on the air. Again, that's 508-289-1285. And last and probably least this week, for those who've always wanted to know why the chicken crossed the road, well, researchers at Griffith University in Australia have looked at whether birds cross roads and found that many, particularly small forest-dwelling species, avoid crossing roads, even when they can fly across them. The bigger the road, the stronger the effect. They're not sure exactly why, but say it may be fear of exposing themselves to predators, or they may be using roads as territorial boundaries. So that chicken that crossed the road may have been one bold bird. You can find that story and more on our website, capeandislands.org. You can also find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.